It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The credibility of the media has been questioned since the days of yellow journalism. Maybe that skepticism about the media has never been so great as it's been, say, over the last couple of years. David Folkenflik is the media correspondent for NPR. He's also the host on Fridays of the national program On Point. David will be a keynoter at the Media Innovation Speaker Series in Pittsburgh at the Pittsburgh Playhouse at Point Park University, January 15th. David Folkenflik, welcome to The Confluence.
I'm so glad to join you.
David, 2018, I guess it could be called a wild ride. In your mind, what were the highs? What were the lows? Were there any highs in this busy last year?
I think most of the highs happened in the pages and on the broadcasts and on the websites of news outlets, providing, despite often waning resources, the best possible journalism they could, often, although not always, despite rather than because of the kinds of leadership and management that they experienced. And there's some really good journalism going on, some real investigative work, some accountability reporting, some textured stuff that happened, you know, in the pages of local newspapers to some of the biggest outlets in the country. The lowlights, man, where do you start? I think that, you know, there are a couple of major strains going on. There's the question of the relationship of the press to the presidency and to the ascendant bloc within the Republican Party that essentially negates the legitimacy of the press itself to perform a kind of balance of power, a check on power, the kind of accountability we expect from news outlets. And that, of course, is personified in the president, but it's been going on for a while. It's interesting to see these the kind of a variety of different themes, right? You've got the question of the fights with the president over this, and you've also got the question of certain kinds of news outlets trying to negotiate not a peace with the president, but what their role is, how they can maintain a kind of impartiality and still perform their critical function, which at a time when you have a presidency like this one is, if anything, all the more important.
Since you raised the issue of the administration, have some media sort of doubled down and given more fuel to President Trump in his claims against the media as a whole?
There are those journalists who believe that that's the case, and that a confluence of factors from the shock that the media had in Trump's victory to the disruptive way in which he's governed. And in which his administration has unfolded to the precedent and institution-shattering approach that he's taken, to the fact that there's, you know, such one scandal after another that almost overwhelms the media system, that has led for this a kind of backlash from journalists. And you see it playing out with Voice on social media. And you see it sometimes with the freedom given in the Voice, the voicing, the narrative shaping, the phrasing of stories that appear even on the front pages of major news outlets that you think of as pretty, as aspiring to be pretty straight ahead. I do think this is happening at the same time over the past 15 years, two decades, where the media has shifted from the idea of objectivity, which sounds like it means that we don't have any fixed beliefs or any stake in any arguments, but are just empirically presenting facts and letting you do with it what you will as a reader or as a member of the audience. And we're moving more to a model of fairness, and that is that we want to render events as they really occurred, and we want to be fair to all sides. Well, these are different approaches. And so you've seen Trump sort of at this almost five-highway intersection, right, where you see social media allowing for greater voice. You see an incredibly disruptive president scramble the paradigms for how you approach coverage. And you see a shift in how journalism conceives of itself. I think that's tied to both the evolution of new outlets on the web and tied to evolution of new outlets on cable, really scrambling what journalists are doing so that the audience come by and say, wow, there's a whole lot of voice coming at me. There's a whole lot of snark. There's a whole lot of attitude, and I'm not up for it. And a lot of viewers and readers and listeners see that as bias, and there may be moments in which that's true.
Our guest is David Folkenflik. David, when you introduce yourself to people, you are media correspondent. So do they understand your role?
I am not the guy who's saying, listen, I gave this a 7 out of 10, and I'm roughly in keeping with Rotten Tomatoes for the Adam McKay movie about Dick Cheney. Haven't seen the movie yet. So people wonder about, well, how can you report on the media when you're of the media? And that's the most frequent question I get. Or often, how do you report on NPR when you get your, when you're paid by NPR? And the answer is, these are institutions that require us to hold them accountable as we would any other major force in society, whether it be governmental or corporate or labor unions or religious institutions or whatever. And to give them a pass because we happen to be part of the media, it seems to me, would be to let them to get away with stuff. And let's look at the lows of the past 18 months. And it's not about necessarily events of the past 18 months, but it's about what we've learned and about the ways in which media figures trading in particular on stature and status and influence and perceived power. Powerful men were able to leverage those positions over women subordinates or business associates. And that proved true not just in the other institutions that media covers, but the media itself. And I think that's a terrible blow to the stature and prestige of media, even as at times the media has performed incredibly admirably in covering this about some of their rival and sister institutions, and in some cases about covering their own.
Covering your own, at NPR, you broke news of a sexual harassment scandal that resulted in management changes. So where does the in-house investigation stand now? And have there, in your view, been any substantive culture changes at NPR?
Sure. And let me be clear to listeners, if it wasn't from the outset, I don't speak for management, and I think they're probably pretty happy about that. I cover them, and to their great credit, they give me the liberty to do what I need to do to cover them. The Washington Post did the first iteration where they came forward with a story about two unnamed accusers of our former chief news executive and his behavior towards them a little over 20 years ago now. And that opened the floodgates and allowed me to really report on things that had happened at NPR and to get people on the record who had not been willing to go on the record and really take a look at that. And let's be clear, while what Mike Oreskes, our former head of news, did was merited his dismissal, being forced out, it is not of the level of the severity of the accusations against, say, Harvey Weinstein, the producer, or Matt Lauer, or Les Moonves, where there's a question of non-consensual sex acts being alleged. But in his case, it completely tainted the way in which women in the newsroom dealt with him and felt about questions about the degree to which they were or weren't advanced in their careers. We had a cultural issue. They did a thorough review of the degree to which his decisions seemed predicated on his advances towards women. They looked at a couple of other people about whom accusations had been made. They looked at gender equity and pay. And they also looked at the question of, for example, temporary employees and reclassified a bunch of people who had been temporary employees as permanent ones. Our temps are these days paid commensurately and have union protection, but they don't have permanence of status, and that creates great insecurity. And there was a surprisingly high number of folks here working on temporary status. And so they've reclassified some folks and made some steps, I'm sure not sufficient in the mind of many staffers, but the amount of attention that extremely senior executives have paid to this issue, sustained over more than a year now, has been extraordinary. I haven't seen anything quite like it at other places. My sense is, it's a work in progress, and people are withholding full judgment until it completely plays out. But there has been a lot of substantive change at NPR, I would say.
Of course, NPR, not alone, as you alluded to, Me Too and the other movements have shaken careers, media outlets. In mid-December, you reported on more harassment allegations at CBS that the executive producer of CBS This Morning is out. Do we feel like this wave is still rising?
Well, the funny thing is, you'd think by now that all that could be known would be known and it would all be out. But actually, it's taken quite some time for some of the repercussions to play out, the aftershocks. At CBS, to me, in some ways, the highest bar, but it's really the example against which you measure all these things in some ways is Fox News, where it turned out that the creator of it with Rupert Murdoch and the longtime chairman of Fox News, Roger Ailes, essentially backwards engineered a network to allow him to sexually harass women. Mm. On the other hand, what happened at CBS is astonishing. Les Moonves seemingly credibly accused multiple times of making sexual advances on subordinates, at times physically making sexual advances, having somebody at his beck and call for sexual favors on staff. You know, real problems there. And it turned out that there were questions about one of their biggest stars at CBS News, Charlie Rose, and that those were really only addressed after the Me Too thing erupted and news reports came out. Jeff Fager, who had been one of Rose's champions as the executive producer of 60 Minutes, which itself had had longtime culture of essentially hard drinking culture, it turned out, a culture where I think in a different era they would have said there was a lot of skirt chasing. Well, that in this day and age, that's not how we think about it. We think about it as sexual harassment and sexual advances, many of them, as it turned out, deeply unwanted. It turned out one of the legal reviews at CBS determined that a woman who had been a former employee there had been paid, I think, $5 million over the years as part of a settlement against allegations she made against the late Don Hewitt, who had been the founding executive producer of 60 Minutes, and that her payments had gone well past his death to as recently as last year. This was a cultural thing.
We're talking with NPR's David Folkenflik. David, let me ask you about the media landscape. Here in Pittsburgh, we've experienced some radical shifts the last few years. One daily newspaper, the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, ceased printing, and now down to a handful of reporters in the city, all publishing online. The remaining daily newspaper is reduced to 5 days a week. The Post-Gazette lost its executive editor. In terms of traditional legacy media, does that sort of jive with what you're seeing nationally?
Yeah, and let's take a moment and say how lucky Pittsburgh has been in having David Shribman, although no doubt he would say how lucky he's been in having the Post-Gazette to lead these years. He's a really remarkable and distinctive journalist who dedicated to, important local and regional coverage there. Pittsburgh was something of an anomaly in having a second outlet. And while the Tribune Review might not always have provided full coverage and, its critics would argue perhaps have been guided by a certain kind of agenda from its ownership from time to time, it's a benefit to have more coverage rather than less. And at the same time, I do think you're seeing an incredible pressure and on local and regional news outlets and a real constriction of ambition as a result. You're seeing even news organizations owned by what are seen to be relatively enlightened corporate ownership. Take the McClatchy Corporation, which combined with the old Knight Ridder news chain some years ago, which really seems to have something in its DNA that cares very much about local journalism. It is shedding a lot of jobs and consolidating a lot of operations and editing functions and design in these regional hubs as a way of trying to save money to keep enough resources afloat so that they can be viable, profitable entities and still get out the news. And, the trend lines are in very bleak directions. It's you've seen great success for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, particularly in the age of Trump with digital subscriptions. But you're seeing a lot less of that on the local level. And there was real patchwork system among local and regional newspapers about should we do this, should we not do this. Now everybody says we need this money because all these advertising dollars have flowed away from us to the digital giants, to Facebook and Google and others online, where we can at least seemingly have much more of a sense of who's reading us and when in terms of our advertising versus maybe somebody's opening the newspaper and maybe it's not.
You mentioned pressure on local regional outlets. How should public media pick up any slack?
I think, as the ambitions of others constrict, I think you want to see the ambitions of public media expand. I think that there is exceptionally important role to play in accountability journalism in state capitals across the country, in city halls, partnering at some times. I think the role for public media is more vital than ever. I really believe that. I think it shouldn't be a safe space, but it should be a civil space for people to hash out issues, talk through things, be exposed to other ways of thinking about things or issues that might affect their communities, but they might not themselves be aware of. And if we aren't all reading a couple of papers that have the ability and time to lay these things out, you know, I think public media has an incredibly important role to play in that.
Finally, of course, you'll be in Pittsburgh January 15th as part of the Media Innovators Speaker Series at the Pittsburgh Playhouse at Point Park University. All right. What can we expect from a live Folk and Flick experience?
Oh, it's going to be incredible. I think you'll pretty much change your worldview. people will be swapping sweatshirts and coming out as completely different people. I don't know. I'm intending to talk to folks about the media moment that we find ourselves in, how we can trust what we're receiving in a you know, in our newspaper, on our broadcasts, on our smartphones, how we can consume this information and what things we should be keeping in mind as we absorb all this stuff. I mean, you know, let's be fair to folks. I think absorbing the news right now in some ways requires more of us than it ever has before. It's a more aerobic and muscular endeavor than it's ever been. It demands more of us. And so I kind of want to offer people a couple of tools and ways of thinking about things that equip them to do that and to think about it. You know, I hope it's fun. I hope people come loaded with questions because part of what I get out of these events is I get the ability to sharpen what people are themselves thinking through and thinking about. And it helps me both as your media correspondent and as a host and as a journalist, but also as a citizen figuring this stuff out myself.
David Folk and Flick is the media correspondent for NPR. He's also the Friday host of On Point, heard on stations across the country. David will be speaking in Pittsburgh January 15th as part of the Media Innovators Speaker Series at the Pittsburgh Playhouse. Tickets are available at pittsburghplayhouse.com. David, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet.
I'm Kevin Gavin, and you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
David Bowie knew his time on Earth was coming to an end when he released his album Black Star on this day in 2016. Bowie's 25th studio album was recorded secretly in New York City with his longtime producer Tony Visconti and a group of local jazz musicians. Visconti later described the record as Bowie's parting gift to his fans. Bowie died of liver cancer just 2 days later. His illness had not yet been made public.
Look up here, I'm in heaven.
At the Grammys the following year, Black Star took home awards for Best Alternative Music Album and Best Recording Package. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to the governor's office, one in three working-age Pennsylvanians has a criminal record. And for many, that means diminished access to jobs and housing. Late last year, Pennsylvania became the first state to pass a clean slate law that would allow people convicted of minor, nonviolent infractions to have those records sealed. We're going to discuss what this means to the lives and livelihoods of many Pennsylvanians with Jamie Gullen, a staff attorney with Community Legal Services of Philadelphia. Welcome, Jamie.
Thank you for having me.
And in studio with us, Tracy Lewis is an adjunct professor at Duquesne University School of Law and teaches at the Civil Rights Clinic, along with Barbara Griffin, who also serves as the director of the Pro Bono Center for the Allegheny County Bar Foundation. Welcome, Tracy and Barbara.
Hi. Good morning.
All right. So many of us look to get a fresh start, a change of jobs, maybe a change of careers. How difficult is it to get a fresh start if you have a record, even if it's for a summary offense, sort of like a ticket, but technically an arrest, or other nonviolent misdemeanors? What are the impediments? Jamie, let's start with you.
Great. Yes. We say in our office that there is no criminal record too old or too minor to impact somebody's ability to get a job. We see everything from old summary offenses to traffic offenses to misdemeanors, that even arrests that didn't lead to conviction can prevent people from becoming employed. And that's because about 90% of employers use some kind of criminal background check process when deciding when to hire somebody. And of course, technology these days makes that kind of information so readily available that it's very easy for employers to utilize that. So there's a huge need for a variety of remedies to help people with records overcome those barriers and become employed.
That's correct, Jamie. And even if individuals that, again, like have non-convictions, just having an arrest, there are many individuals that have an arrest record that will greatly impede their progress to get employment and housing.
And there's some misperceptions among the public. We'll have folks who come in looking for help and they'll say, well, I just assumed that this would automatically go away since I was never convicted of this crime, or they threw out the charges. But we know that's not true.
Mm-hmm. So what are offenses are covered by Clean Slate? We mentioned summary offenses. We also mentioned nonviolent misdemeanors. Give us an example of what those could be. Tracy?
Sure. A nonviolent misdemeanor, some of the common ones that will now be affected by Clean Slate include drug possession, DUIs, thefts, prostitution charges. So those types of nonviolent misdemeanor charges.
Any others that stick out to you, Barbara, that are important that do affect people's lives?
Things like shoplifting is one that we commonly see.
Okay. So I want to get a sense of what does it mean? We've used these terms. What does it mean to have a record sealed? What does the process look like now and after Clean Slate? Jamie, we're going to start with you.
Sure. So sealing means that the information is no longer accessible by the public. So we have a court website in Pennsylvania where criminal records are all available online for free. Once a record's sealed, it's no longer going to show up on that public-facing website. Employers who are running criminal background checks should not be able to see it. The same goes for landlords or schools. So basically, the general public will no longer be able to access that information. But law enforcement and the court systems will still have access to that information. So unlike expungement, where the record's completely destroyed, there is some what's called limited access for certain users of that information, but it's no longer publicly available.
And some licensing agencies may also be able to see some of the those convictions still.
Such as, Tracy?
Like nursing or securities licensing, if somebody wants to get in the securities field. Mm-hmm. So those types of licensing agencies.
Jamie brought up law enforcement, but do they just have immediate access? Do they have to go through any process, a petition, to get access to that information?
Not that I'm aware of. They have immediate access to those records.
Okay, so it's no impediments for law enforcement? Okay. So how does this new sealing process contrast with what it took before Clean Slate? So whether it was a drug offense, shoplifting, a DUI that you mentioned, what was the process then compared to now? Tracy, I'll start with you and then get.
Sure. I think the biggest benefit for individuals with Clean Slate is that misdemeanor convictions, under the previous law, an individual could only get that off their record by going through the pardon process. And that's getting a governor's pardon. Now, through Clean Slate, an individual has the ability to get a misdemeanor conviction removed from their record without going through that process, which is a lot longer. A governor's pardon can take up to 3 years, whereas going through Clean Slate, once all of the information is received and the motion is filed with the court, it can take only perhaps 3 months to get an order back having that record sealed.
Jamie, Barbara, so possibly a three-year process for a gubernatorial pardon, but how frequent is that? Is beside the extensive time frame, is it also difficult?
Through the law clinic at Duquesne, we do gubernatorial pardons. It's a time commitment, but we just received five clients that got pardons from the governor that we filed over the past 2 years. So it does happen. Individuals can get a pardon. It is a time commitment to put in.
All right. Jamie, I wanted to ask you this, a follow-up to that. And does Community Legal Services of Philadelphia work with individuals to get those gubernatorial pardons?
Yes, we do. And as others have said, that process is quite lengthy and time consuming. And our hope is that Clean Slate will actually lead to the sealing of a lot of the types of records that traditionally people would apply to the Board of Pardons with. So hopefully by those cases getting sealed, that will free up the Board of Pardons to be able to move a little bit more quickly on the remaining cases that still have to go to them. And I do just want to note that one of the other great things about Clean Slate is, in addition to expanding the eligibility for what kinds of misdemeanor convictions can be sealed, there's also an automatic provision of Clean Slate that goes into effect this coming June, where certain types of criminal record information will be automatically sealed via a computer query process, so that it will actually eliminate the need for people to file petitions on certain types of records at all. So we're going from a very lengthy process to an extremely fast automated process where people won't even need to file petitions with the court.
So what does clean slate mean to an offender in terms of their peace of mind, getting that record sealed through a speedier process than a pardon? Barbara?
Well, you know, as the economy grows and their jobs are available, it can open up opportunities for someone who has had a criminal record as a barrier to employment. So it really can change a person's life.
Tracy?
And it can, again, free up their opportunities to be able to get employment, to be able to get housing, and just give them peace of mind.
Okay. More on Pennsylvania's Clean Slate Law when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence on WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about Pennsylvania's first-in-the-nation Clean Slate Law and its impact on many Pennsylvanians' lives with Jamie Gullen with Community Legal Services of Philadelphia, Tracy Lewis of Duquesne University School of Law, and Barbara Griffin with the Allegheny County Bar Foundation, the Pro Bono Center. Before we went to break, we talked about who would have access to information that is sealed and who would not. I want to ask you, what happens if you've had your record sealed? Can an employer in an interview setting ask you if you have a record? Tracy?
Oftentimes on employment applications, there is a box that you have to check indicating if
that's
you...
That's the check the box, yes.
That's the check the box. Under the law, once you had your record expunged, you no longer have a requirement to indicate that you have been convicted of a crime.
All right. So what I'm getting at is once you're past that and somebody looks at your application, that box is not there, and now you've gotten an interview. Does an employer have a right to ask an individual?
So one great thing about the new Clean Slate Law is that it actually even clarifies this issue further. And it says once your record has been expunged or sealed, an individual who is going up for a job and is in that interview setting can say that they do not have a record because it's like the offense never occurred. So for the first time, really, it will give people more confidence when they're in that kind of interviewing setting and they're being asked about that record to say, you know, no, I do not have a record. So that will really help people's job prospects.
So, Jamie, they're being truthful by saying they don't have a record because it has been cleaned. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
As if it never occurred. Right.
Good. Okay. So, the first phase of the Clean Slate Law took effect just before the new year. So, how did it come about? How did it get enacted? Jamie, I know that you were part of the legislative process at your organization. How did it come about?
So the idea for Clean Slate really came about from just how many petitions are filed for expungement around the state and the tremendous resources that go into filing these petitions one by one. It's resources for our courts, for individuals who, you know, try to find a lawyer to do this for them. It's a very onerous process. And so the idea from Clean Slate was really, how can we streamline this, especially for information like arrests that didn't even lead to a conviction? How can we make this process something where technology can really help us to just automatically seal that? So that's where the idea started. And it attracted bipartisan support across the board because it's really a common sense reform that just helps people move forward with their lives, get employment, and also just saves tremendous money and resources for our court systems. So because of that, it really just attracted such a wide range of bipartisan support, both in our legislature and even from national advocacy groups that really helped to push it over the finish line.
Tracy?
Right, and this was a law that just made sense. As Jamie said, with the bipartisan support, everybody realized that individuals want to work. We see clients every day that are looking to get back into the workforce, but their record is an impediment to that. And so when you're having individuals that want to go to work, let's give them the opportunity and the ability to get back into the workforce.
So you mentioned the bills were passed, rare bipartisan support, overwhelming. Governor Wolf was in favor, as was his Republican challenger in the recent gubernatorial election, Scott Wagner. The very politically active Koch brothers actually threw in their support, and of course so did the ACLU. So if a change like that was necessary and supported, why did it take so long to get passed?
Well, I think any time it comes to getting legislation passed, you know, it's a process. And, you know, this law was a few years in the making in terms of the legislative process. But it really all came together, and the bipartisan support was absolutely critical to it getting done. And we're hoping that now that all these, you know, organizations and individuals have worked together to get Clean Slate passed, it will set the groundwork for the future to be able to keep moving forward to have even more reforms that will help people be able to become employed and move past their records.
Barbara.
And this benefits employers also.
Also.
They need workers. And I've heard from job applicants who said, you know, they wanted to hire me, they needed me, but, you know, their policy just kind of kept this from, you know, this record kept them from being able to hire me. And so I think that it enhances the workforce and makes workers more available to employers who need them.
Exactly. And I think if we look at our society with the aging workforce that we have here in the United States and in Pennsylvania, you have a lot of people that were leaving the workforce. They're aging out. And then if you have a whole segment of our population that's not able to get employment because of their record, I think people finally realize that having a criminal record affects many people, and it was having a great impact on our businesses and our opportunity for employment.
Pennsylvania is not always the first to do something. So is there, I mean, although it took a while and it seemed to make sense and there was bipartisan support, is there maybe a sense of pride? Well, we at least we're first.
Absolutely. I think that's definitely the case. And Pennsylvania is now being held up as a model for the country. There are many states who are this year proposing their own versions of Clean Slate legislation. So Pennsylvania leading the way has really inspired a lot of other states to take up this issue and to try to get similar legislation passed.
I want to get a sense of how many people might we be talking about that will have their record sealed, that can apply to have their record sealed? The records might be automatically sealed come June. Do we have a sense of how many people might be affected by this?
It's hard to know for sure, but we know it's thousands of people. And I'll note that just since we launched our program, MyCleanSlatePA.com, where people can go and fill out a form to see if they'll qualify for Clean Slate, just in the past couple of weeks, we've had over 4,000 people come to that website seeking help to see if Clean Slate will help them. So we know that the impact of this issue of having a criminal record in Pennsylvania is enormous, and we're really hopeful that a lot of people are going to benefit from Clean Slate now with the petition-based filing, and even more so once the automatic Clean Slate goes into effect in June.
I wanted to ask all three of you, whether it's with Community Legal Services Philly, whether it's with the Civil Rights Clinic at Duquesne, whether it's with the Pro Bono Center, do you have the resources to handle that many clients? Tracy, we're going to start with you.
It does get challenging, but there are a number of volunteer attorneys here in the city of Pittsburgh that work on this. We work with Neighborhood Legal Services, Duquesne Law School. We work with Barbara Griffin at the Pro Bono Center also.
Barbara.
Yeah, I think one of the things we do at the Pro Bono Center is train volunteer attorneys to handle these cases. There may be many attorneys who are experienced in this area who could pick it up right away. But for others who are looking to volunteer who don't have experience, we can help train them, get them ready, and refer clients to them. So it's something that we're working on really hard. And, get ready.
Yeah, and Jamie, you mentioned thousands already. Do you have the resources? I think on your website, you put out a call for volunteer attorneys to help out.
Absolutely. So one of the great things, again, about Clean Slate is that once the automatic piece goes into effect, hopefully it will relieve a lot of the burden on organizations like all of ours, because people don't need to file petition by petition to get a lot of items sealed from their record. But a big part of what we want to do is let people know they're going to benefit from that, as well as for people who do want to start filing petitions now. So the goal with our project is to recruit a lot of volunteer attorneys who can help provide consultations and advice to the people who are signing up to say, I really want to know if Clean Slate is going to help me. So we are recruiting volunteer lawyers. We've had a great response so far from attorneys who want to sign up to help with this. So we're confident that, you know, it'll take some time to handle the huge volume of people, but we're really confident that we're going to have a lot of attorneys who are eager to help out with this project.
One big caveat to the law, no fines or court costs be owed. Do you anticipate that being a stumbling block for any people?
Definitely. We have a number of individuals right now, even under the current expungement law, you must have all court cost fees, restitution paid off on your cases. So for a lot of individuals, it's cyclical. If someone has a record and they can't get a job, or they can't get a job that is able, where they're able to pay their bills, they're not able to save up that money to pay things off. So, it can be a major barrier and impediment for a lot of individuals to have a zero balance on their case.
Is 10 years exceedingly long? Couldn't you really get frustrated during that time where your employment and housing opportunities might be limited because of a nonviolent misdemeanor or a summary offense? What I'm getting at is this. Is there any chance of follow-up legislation that could reduce that 10-year time frame? Jamie, do you know?
I think that would be wonderful. Social science research shows that after between 3 to 4 to 7 years after somebody's convicted, the chances that they're going to commit another offense go so far down that it's no different than somebody who's never had a conviction. So I think the research tells us that we could bring down that 10-year waiting period quite a bit. So hopefully that will be an area for future reform efforts.
Jamie mentioned that Pennsylvania law, sort of a model for the nation. I was curious, any of you heard from your counterparts elsewhere how to go about doing this in their states? Tracy, have you heard anything?
No, other law professors have done some similar projects with regard to expungement clinics, but nothing like this in Pennsylvania.
I haven't yet. There's a big conference that's held every year for legal aid attorneys. I'm thinking that's going to be something that we'll be discussing there. So.
And what about you, Jamie?
Yes, our office is actually involved in working with other legal aid advocates around the country who are working on their own Clean Slate legislation. We've put together a Clean Slate toolkit that can help advocates advance their own Clean Slate legislation using some of the lessons learned that we've had here in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania. And our My Clean Slate PA website will be a resource going forward where we're going to continually add resources and materials like that. So people should definitely check out that website for more information.
All right. We have in just a couple of sentences, one of you to answer this. What information should somebody bring to you, have ready to try to have their record cleaned? Tracy, why don't you take that?
The information that we need from them, name, date of birth, we're able to look their information up on the record that Jamie mentioned, Pennsylvania website, to get that information. And from there, we can kind of glean as to what can come off of their record through Clean Slate.
All right. That was Tracy Lewis. She's an adjunct professor at Duquesne University School of Law, teaches at the Civil Rights Clinic. Jamie Gullin is a staff attorney with Community Legal Services of Philadelphia. And Barbara Griffin, who teaches also at the Civil Rights Clinic at Duquesne University and is the director of the Pro Bono Center for the Allegheny County Bar Foundation. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was produced and engineered by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Meg Fair, the editor and producer of The Confluence, is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.